From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange, and we'll look at yesterday's primaries across the country and what the Tea Party's continued success might mean. We'll also get some analysis on the first gubernatorial debate last night in Sioux City and ask the question, how much do debates really matter? Also, with the campaigns launching new ad assaults on their opponents, we'll discuss the latest battles taking shape on the airwaves. And at the end of the hour, we remember legendary Iowa newsman Jack Shelley. Our guests today, political analyst Arnie Arneson and political science professor Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. That's all coming up right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, and it's Politics Day here on The Exchange. We'll look at yesterday's primaries across the country, what the Tea Party's continued success might mean, also some analysis about the first gubernatorial debate that was held last night in Sioux City, and ask the question, how much do debates matter anyway? Also, those campaigns launching new ad assaults on their opponents. We'll discuss the latest battles taking shape on the airwaves. And at the end of the hour, we want to remember legendary Iowa newsman Jack Shelley, who died last night in Ames at the age of 98. Listeners, we want to have you in on our conversation. As always on Politics Day, what's on your political mind? Join us this hour, 1-866-780-9100, or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email, also on Twitter at IPRTalk. Glad to welcome our guests for this edition of Politics Day here on The Exchange. Bruce Nesmith is the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor and Chair of Political Science at Coe College, joining us by phone. Professor Nesmith, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Great to have you with us. Also with us, New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Good afternoon, Arnie.
Good afternoon, and we had one of those primaries yesterday.
Boy, let's get right to it, talking about these primaries. The biggest news, Christine O'Donnell stunning Mike Castle in Delaware for the GOP Senate nomination, a well-known fixture in New York politics, Rick Lazio, going down in New York's GOP gubernatorial primary, a very close race in New Hampshire. I don't have the last word on it in the GOP Senate race. Let's start off with you, Arnie. What are we witnessing with the GOP in these primaries?
Well, you know, what's interesting is, and as a former candidate for office, I've been a candidate for governor and a candidate for Congress, I also want to remind people that some people are going to be labeled Tea Party candidates when, in fact, they may not be. And I'm going to use the campaign in the state of New Hampshire. Ovid LaMontagne is now being claimed by the Tea Party because he is now within striking distance of the Republican-anointed candidate, Kelly Ayotte, who was the former attorney general, who also happened to have been endorsed months ago by Sarah Palin. But she never really let anyone know that because we really don't like Sarah Palin that much in New Hampshire. But all of a sudden, her conservative credentials were being challenged by Ovid LaMontagne, who has been a conservative and respected within the conservative community for decades. Remember the word decades here. Mm-hmm. And as he was beginning to gain momentum, the Tea Party hadn't even found him yet, she suddenly realized that she had to pull Sarah Palin out of her pocket, and there were robocalls all weekend just to make sure that everyone knew, oh, I'm a conservative, even if you never knew it before. So this is so interesting because everyone claims ownership, and sometimes the ownership happened within the last 48 hours because they saw someone exceeding expectation and had the potential for win, which may be one of the reasons why Senator DeMint, who also has been sprinkling his fairy dust around the United States, on Friday night, he tweeted for O'Donnell and Ovid LaMontagne. And O'Donnell and Ovid LaMontagne were surging. And of course, you're looking at the state of Delaware, where O'Donnell has been a perennial candidate from everything, for U.S. Senate to dog catcher. She's been on Bill Maher. I mean, this woman, I mean, whenever you're looking for a candidate, you can find Christine. Isn't it interesting that the Tea Party suddenly claims her? You know, where were they years ago? Of course, they didn't exist, but she has been around for a long time.
Arnie, a lot of this taking place in your neck of the woods there in the East. When we look at all these, this latest round of primaries and the results, what are we witnessing in the GOP? I was reading some analysis that mentioned the word purge, a purge of the GOP.
Well, it may be a purge, but the potential is for a loss in November. So you might have won the battle but lost the war. And you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that's going on, and Bruce, you've seen this in polling, is that Republicans are disliked even more than Democrats. So when you see those kind of polling numbers, you begin to realize that it's not about you want the other party. You want something completely different. And there's such incredible intensity and anger on the side of Republicans, but it's not just at Barack Obama. It's not just at the economy. It's about the failure of their own party. The problem is when you go too far to the extreme, you may not have set it up for a win in November.
Bruce Nesmith, let's go to you, Co-College. What's the takeaway you have for us from this latest and last round of primaries before the midterm election?
Well, I guess that neither party should count their chickens before they hatch. I think one arguable reason for the some of the strange, unpredictable outcomes in Republican primaries have been that Republicans have been feeling, understandably, very confident about the outcome of races in the House and Senate and governor's races this fall. And so, you feel at some point you feel like, you know, I don't have to be pragmatic. I can have the candidate I want. I can have my dream candidate because they're going to win whoever, you know, we've already won. It's just a matter of how conservative do we want to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the lesson maybe for Democrats is don't look at the victory of Christine O'Donnell in Delaware or the fellow who won the Republican primary in New York. Don't look at that as automatically guaranteeing a Democratic victory in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
Don't start getting overconfident because that's when strange things start happening.
On this note, though, I also want to mention this news in from the Iowa Electronic Markets. I believe both of you are familiar with this. This is operated by the University of Iowa's Tippie College of Business. It's a real money futures prediction market with an impressive record. And this is interesting, Arnie and Bruce. The markets took a turn on the news of yesterday's primary results. Traders now believe a Republican takeover of both the House and Senate is about 16%. That's a 34% drop from yesterday afternoon. They see a split with a Republican-controlled House and a Democratically-controlled Senate more likely. Futures were trading 57.4 cents today, 21% increase over yesterday. The price of a contract representing continued Democratic control of both chambers was also up slightly from 2.8 cents to 24.3 cents. You don't trust this electronic. how would you handicap the chances for these likelihoods? The two houses of Congress.
First of all, let me remind everyone. I mean, Bruce, you're right. Nobody can be overconfident. This is an electorate that is having a tantrum. Can I repeat that word? A tantrum. They are angry. They are frustrated. They are afraid. They want to know where their jobs are. They want to know why you can't, twinkle your nose and bring the jobs back. They're angry at Barack Obama because he didn't do it fast enough. They're angry at George Bush because where did he take us? They don't understand why we're at war with people. Think about it. It was 18 of the 19 folks that were involved in the 9/11 debacle were Saudis, but we went to war in Afghanistan and Iraq. Excuse me, I'm confused. So everyone is having a tantrum. But you have to get into the weeds when you begin to look at some of these final primaries, for example. The primary in Delaware was a primary where only Republicans were allowed to pick up a ballot and vote. In the state of New Hampshire where I live, Republicans and undeclareds / independents are allowed to make a choice whether they want to pick up a Democratic primary ballot or a Republican ballot. When you have Delaware, where only Republicans, we're probably in a state where a lot of Republicans have left their party affiliation and have become either undeclared or independent, you have only a very sort of extreme, more conservative, angry group of people that are going to pick up the primary ballot. That was very unhelpful to the National Republican Party because they would really more approve of more moderates being able to show up, but that didn't happen. I think your electronic ticker is probably right today, but how many more weeks do we have to the November election?
Right.
And everything changes.
What
happened with O'Donnell was really, I think, also an anger on the part of a lot of voters because the National Republican Party was trying to tell them what to do.
Let's talk about those few weeks before the elections, the midterm elections, in light of the Tea Party's influence, as demonstrated by this last primary. How do each of you see the campaign strategies for the major parties shaping up? Bruce Nesmith, let me go to you and forecast what's going to be happening in terms of strategies these next few weeks.
Well, I think for those people who like their politics uplifting and positive, it's going to be a long few weeks. It may only be seven, but it might seem like 70 times seven, because I think the referendum, I think Arnie's description of the public mood is spot on, and I think that where this is turning is on economic conditions primarily and on democratic stewardship of the economy. And I think that Republicans pretty much have been able to have clean hands on the economy because most Republicans have kept a distance from the Bush administration. So, we can complain about deficits. You can talk about the Bush administration's economic policy, but that wasn't, they were spending. That wasn't us. That was the Bush administration kind of thing. So it's really focused on the Democratic attitudes or the Democratic stewardship of the economy. And the Democrats' hope is, I think, in key races to take the focus off of the economy onto some of the candidates that are running as Republicans for Christina O'Donnell or Sharon Angle in Nevada or people like that.
Paint the entire party as extremists.
Or go race by race. You don't have to run the whole party as extremists because, some people... Terry Branstad, like him or not, is not an extremist, and I don't think you're going to be able to get away with that quite as clearly in Iowa as you would in Maryland Delaware or places like that. So the idea is to say, the economy is what it is, and it was Bush's fault anyway, but, look at these wackos. Mm-hmm. So it's going
and
to be basically
Party...
wackos versus incompetence, and
right.
That's not
right.
Particularly uplifting.
Okay, just a minute, Arnie. I want to throw out the number before we go to you. How do our listeners read the last night's primary election results? 1-866-780-9100. What do you think about the influence of the Tea Party? 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Cast us forward into these next few weeks, Arnie Arneson.
Well, I think the Republican National Committee now has really, they're probably in therapy. And the reason they're in therapy right now is their initial reaction, for example, to Christine O'Donnell was, she's not getting a dime, we don't acknowledge her, we can't believe this headache has just happened. That has already changed. It has changed in like 9 hours.
So the GOP will be backing her.
Yes. They're backing her. They're cutting big checks. They're all laying hands on her. This is fine, but this is the problem for the Republican Party, because if there are individual races where certain candidates probably should not be embraced, they really cannot carry the message. They do have a portfolio of failure. Christine O'Donnell has an interesting history. I mean, over the weekend, I don't know if people know this, but over the weekend, the Republican National Committee actually brought a former Christine O'Donnell employee to do these, to do an ad, basically saying she's not a conservative, she has so many personal problems, I don't trust her, and the Republican Party is the one that helped to produce that ad. Now they have to somehow shelve that ad of this person they brought out and say, we're sending you a check for $42,000, I hope you win.
Mm-hmm.
That's problematic. What I think the Republican Party is wanting to do is they want to nationalize every single state race, and the Democrats want to localize every single state race. That's really what this is going to be about. But now, all of a sudden, with people like Christine O'Donnell, the Democrats are torn. Do we localize that Delaware race, or do we make Christine the face of the Republican Party across the nation?
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be a fascinating 7 weeks.
Bruce.
And following up on what Arnie said, I think it's a lot easier to make the case that somebody is a wacko if you've got her putative allies saying it. So it's one thing for me as Cons, or whatever the Democratic candidate's name is, to try to make the case. It sounds like just dirty politics if I'm calling my opponent a wacko. But if I've got videotape of major Republicans saying this woman is beyond the pale, that's a lot easier way to make the case.
Okay. Arnie Arneson with us, New Hampshire political analyst, and you're just listening to Bruce Nesmith of Coe College, chair of the political science department there. Before we move on quickly, I want to talk about the governor debates we had last night, candidate debates. When we cast our memories back months to the beginning of the Tea Party last year, it has to have exceeded almost everybody's expectations. Wouldn't you agree, Arnie, your expectations as well, that this headless movement has had so much influence?
Well, but look at who has embraced the Tea Party. I mean, since it is headless, almost any head will do you. Is Sarah Palin one of the heads? Is Glenn Beck one of the heads? Is Newt Gingrich one of the heads? I mean, you've got a Hydra now, you know? And so, right. and a Hydra has sort of one body, maybe, but it has many faces, many heads. Everyone can embrace it at any time. And then you have to keep asking, where's the money coming from? I think in some ways the fact that it is so amorphous makes it so much more lethal.
Mm. So, you know? Yeah, it's a good question. Who are the real GOP leaders?
Exactly.
Palin, DeMint, Beck, Hannity, Limbaugh?
And I think that's one of the reasons why they can claim success at so many different levels, and no one really knows what the dynamic was in the state, because some Tea Party person is going to represent that, you know, I won this. I mean, when I heard that DeMint had tweeted for Ovid LaMontagne on Friday, I'm thinking, has he ever met him? But what he did was see that, you know, and remember, there's another problem going on, especially in places like Iowa and New Hampshire. Why would DeMint, for example, tweet this conservative candidate for the United States Senate, who up until a week and a half ago was running third or fourth? And the rumor on the street is he's possibly considering a run for president in 2012. So, again, some of the dynamics that are going on, especially in places like New Hampshire, have very little to do with, you know, state politics and the U.S. Senate race, but have to do with national politics, because the National Republican Party knows that when they campaign, they're going to come to Iowa to regroup, they're going to come to New Hampshire to regroup. That's why they want a Terry Branstad as governor. That's why they would love it if an Ovid LaMontagne became the next U.S. senator. Those are part of the reasons why this is bigger than just the two states we're looking at.
Arnie Arneson and Bruce Nesmith, let's move now to the gubernatorial debates, the first of them last night in Sioux City. No time was wasted jumping right into the attack mode at last night's gubernatorial debate. Democratic incumbent Chet Culver said Republican Terry Branstad was lying to voters, while Branstad accused Culver of mismanaging state government, racking up debt. Branstad, who defended the merit-based judicial nominating process through the primary, has more recently said on a conservative talk radio program that governors should be able to appoint whomever they want to the Iowa Supreme Court. Last night, he seemed to stake out both positions, one for change.
Unfortunately, it's become very partisan under Governor Culver. We now have on the Judicial Nominating Commission 12 Democrats, many that are very partisan. I believe it needs to be balanced. I believe that it should be like the other boards and commissions in state government, where you have not only gender balance, which you have in the Judicial Nominating Commission, but party balance as well. And if you don't have a balanced board where you have an opportunity to have somebody that you think would be a strict constructionist to appoint, then you need to change the system.
And in the same answer to a question about keeping politics out of the judicial system, he also advocated for the status quo.
Need to restore what we had when Bob Rae was governor and when I was governor, doing it strictly without regard to politics so that we have merit.
Okay, so what is Governor Branstad, former Governor Branstad, trying to balance here? Can you tackle that, Bruce Nesmith?
Well, you know, I think that one key is that we're speaking in generalities. So, looking for examples, can Governor Branstad give an example of somebody that he appointed who may not have been his first choice, who was maybe more to the center than his own constituency, who has made decisions which were not part of the Republican platform? That's when it would get really interesting.
And the backdrop here is Governor Branstad getting pressure from the right, from constituents of his primary opponent, Bob Vanderplaats, upset about the Supreme Court decision clearing the way for same-sex marriage in the state? Arnie Arneson.
Well, you know, as you were describing what Terry Branstad was doing, I kept imagining ordering off a Chinese menu. I was like, I think I'll take a little one from Chinese A, from letter A, and then one from B, and one from C. You know, it's all still in the same conversation, but it doesn't necessarily have any coherency. I think what is interesting is that Sandra Day O'Connor has been traveling around the United States, not just to Iowa. She's been to Wisconsin. She's been to a number of states because she is terribly concerned about the judiciary. And one of the reasons why she came to Iowa was, in fact, I think to praise the system that Iowa has. Not to see a change, but to say, well, you need an independent judiciary. You don't want to see the system change so dramatically that there's a lot of money that gets involved, there's a lot of public retribution that gets involved, and the kind of system that you have created is something that you should maybe to some extent almost treasure. Because, you know, it's based on competency. The governor still has some latitude in between the names that are being offered up. But I think she is fearful about using the judicial branch of government as a political volleyball. Because if anything, she sees it as a stabilizing force and one that is crucial. There are checks and balances in this country, and the judiciary needs to maintain its independence. So I think Terry Branstad knows that. And I think that's part of the reason why he was so conflicted. Not everyone may be happy about gay marriage, but at the same time, what you need to do is have stability, and that's really what the judiciary offers. And I think that's where Terry gets sort of conflicted himself.
Now, both candidates took a lot of time during last night's debate, attacking their opponent's record, leaving voters wondering who could be possibly telling the truth here. It got a little humorous during Governor Culver's closing argument, when he staked out his own positions on key issues, and then he ran down a laundry list of the things former Governor Branstad is against. Let's listen to this. Listen to the background.
The choice on November 2nd is to go back to the past. Terry Branstad is against health care for kids. He's against preschool for four-year-olds. He's against embryonic stem cell research. He's against the Iowa Power Fund that has allowed us to distinguish ourselves as a national leader in renewable energy. He's against women's rights. He's against civil rights. He's against an independent judiciary. And I am for the people of Iowa. I am for moving this state forward. And I'm also here tonight to humbly ask for your vote and your support on November 2nd.
A very clear chuckle of former Governor Branstad there, chuckling at Chet Culver's laundry list there. Is there any value in voters watching this kind of exchange? Bruce Nesmith, what do you make of the exchange and a type of exchange like this? Does this sway voters' opinions?
Well, I think in that particular answer, Culver was clearly overreaching. By the end, you could sort of see that the train running that Branstad is against oxygen and babies and things like that. But, you know, what Culver needs to do is to get some excitement around his governorship. There are a lot of people in here who are in Iowa who kind of incline to the left, who seem subdued or even discouraged. Once in a while, you'll see a letter to the editor or something like that defending Governor Culver. But then when he comes along and sort of says, you know, I've made mistakes, let me start over.
Right. Yeah.
It's hard to get excited about something like that.
You are mentioning exactly what I want to talk about when we come back from the break. Bruce Nesmith with us, professor and chair of political science at Coe College. New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson with us. And we want to know what you thought were the highs and low points as you saw them about last night's debate between Governor Culver and former Governor Branstad. 1-866-780-9100. The toll-free number, 1-866-780-9100. The exchange at iowapublicradio.org. When we come back, we'll listen to ads from Culver and Branstad attacking the other. And we'll continue our discussion. When the exchange continues, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. So nice to have you with us for The Exchange over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow on this program, one of my guests, University of Northern Iowa Professor Harry Broad, his new DVD project is titled Asking for It, The Ethics and Erotics of Sexual Consent. We'll talk about sexual signals and what they really mean. We'll also learn how to address inappropriate and offensive behavior. That's tomorrow. The Exchange over the noon hour here on Iowa Public Radio. Of course, today's Wednesday, so it's Politics Day here on The Exchange, looking in our first half hour at the primaries, last round of primaries across the country with the Tea Party's continued success in many of those races. Also talking about the first gubernatorial debate was held last night in Sioux City. Wanted to remind you, coming up in about 10 minutes, we're going to remember legendary Iowa newsman Jack Shelley. But in the meantime, we continue our discussion with New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson and Professor Bruce Nesmith of Coe College. And we want to ask you to join our conversation talking about the debate last night. If you saw it, what were the high and low points as you saw them in the debate between Culver and Branstad? 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, or The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. This email from Sarah in Kyoto, I wanted to share with you, Arnie and Bruce. My husband and I watched the debates last night. He's an independent and was thinking about voting for Branstad. After watching the debate, he is now leaning towards Culver. One issue that was important to him was access to preschool. We have a one-year-old, and my husband never got to go to preschool because his parents just didn't have the money. He's 26, so Branstad was governor when he could have gone through preschool. We both thought the debate was great and felt Culver won round one. We look forward to watching round two and three, and we'll have to see who he ends up voting for. If you'd like to tell us how you saw the debate last night, 1-866-780-9100. And let's go to Rick in Iowa City. Good afternoon. Rick, you saw the debate?
No, I was doing other things, but I've been listening to the show and talking about how Terry Branstad kind of took one from column A and one from column B, to use Arnie's terms.
The Chinese menu that Arnie was bringing up, right?
Yes. It was kind of like the good old days when the governor was vehemently against gambling and then suddenly turned around and decided that casinos were okay. And that's when I started calling them the human windsock. So I'll take my comments off the air, and thank you for the time.
Okay, Rick, joining us from Iowa City. Before I want to play a couple of ads that each of the campaigns has been airing, launching new assault ads on their opponents. We want to talk about this on the airwaves, and have Bruce and Arnie comment. Here's the big debt Chet ad by the Branstad campaign. Let's have a listen.
Big debt. In Iowa, we call our governor Chet. Said he'd give us jobs, but what we got was big debt.
Big debt. Big bad debt.
His iJobs plan is more than $1 billion in cost, while thousands of Iowans have jobs that are lost. And old Chet spent a couple billion more than he's taken in, pushing property taxes so high it's a sin.
Big debt.
That's all we get from old Governor Chet.
Big bad debt.
Certainly unfortunate for the Culver team that Chet Culver's first name rhymes with debt. Arnie Arneson, an effective ad?
I love it. But you know what? I think what Chet should do, I think he should try to figure out what rhymes with tax. because if you listen to the debate, from what I can tell, is that one was being accused of going into debt, and the other one is being accused of being a taxer.
Right.
So I think we have to find a song that rhymes with tax, and then we can do the same kind of thing. Humor works, believe it or not. And I think this is really important, especially in debates or even in ads, is that when you get too angry and you get too snarly, people tend to clamp down and not listen. But the power of humor is that it's actually memorable and it sticks.
Right.
A simple
message there.
Exactly.
Do you agree, Bruce Nesmith? Effective.
Yes. I was dancing. You couldn't see me because I'm not in the studio, but I was dancing in my office. And, you know, I think it's useless to try to argue that practically every state in the country is running up debt in the recession. It may not be an entirely inappropriate thing to do at this time. It's catchy and it's pithy. I think that's the other thing. It's a simple, straightforward message. There's nothing terribly complex about it.
Okay, we want to play an ad by the Culver campaign. This is unusual in that the governor admits to making mistakes. Let's listen.
As governor of Iowa, I've made my share of mistakes. But they were honest mistakes, and I've listened to your concerns, and I've grown on the job.
We've done our best through tragic floods and a national recession.
We've cut spending to below when we came into office.
We have a surplus and didn't raise taxes.
We've become a national leader in renewable energy, expanded preschools, and made long-term investments in our state.
But we can do better.
And I hope you give us the chance.
Okay, there we have the governor admitting mistakes. If it's a neighbor or a friend of the family, somebody admitting mistakes, I'll take that on face value. But what about a politician? Is that a good idea, Arnie Arneson? Admit mistakes.
You know, I wrote two words down. I wrote, this is the maturity ad. If you're looking for an adult who is willing to recognize his mistakes and learn from them and build from them, you have me. On the other hand, you have Terry Branstad, who makes mistakes, doesn't acknowledge them, and won't make them again.
Okay. How do you...
He doesn't... See, here's the problem. In some ways, it's almost like he missed the exclamation point. There are some of us who make mistakes, learn from them, and are able to move forward. Then there are those of us who basically repeat the mistakes. The beauty of this campaign is that Chet Culver is a governor, but he's running against a former governor. Mm-hmm. You know, five states in the nation have former governors running again, and it gives them an opportunity to point out their failures and say, but did they learn from that mistake, or will they repeat it?
Bruce Nesmith, what do you think about this ad, admitting mistakes? A good idea?
No. And I think the interesting part of the ad is the middle part where he's talking about what they've done, what they've achieved, and that gets lost in the I've made mistakes part at the beginning. I'm not sure if it's an effective appeal. I'm sure that it's not an effective appeal. I did a bad job. Reelect me is the message that comes through. And
we complained. So many people complained. For instance, just to be the devil's advocate during the Bush administration, won't this guy admit any mistake? We wished that he would admit a mistake, and we
well,
would.
Didn't admit then any
mis- he know, didn't admit it, anything. And
Culver didn't admit any mistakes. He just admitted that there had been some.
Right.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's where the exclamation point is missing. He didn't take you to the next level.
Right.
He left you with mistake in your head, but it didn't direct you to why this is an appropriate choice, because mistakes have been made. What were they? And this is where we've rehabilitated. What are they? I don't know. I'm clueless. All I know is that he made a bunch of mistakes, and I have no idea what he's talking about.
Okay, we want to take a quick call before we have to end this discussion. Mary, good afternoon. Where are you calling from, Mary?
I'm calling from rural Ollie, and not far from Kyoto, actually. If the screener had known that, she might not have let me through. But we are political junkies out here on the farm, and we really enjoyed the debate. We expected it not to be as good as it was. And I was impressed with the governor. Neither gentleman are known to be statesmen. And I will say that I felt that both were well prepared, but I think Culver had the edge last night.
One of the comments I heard from a number of people was that the debate was painful to watch. Did you have that feeling, Mary?
No. I've watched so many of them, and I was raised in a mixed household where my father was Republican and my mother Democrat, ardent Democrat. So I'm used to the political yin and yang in an election year, and I've watched some very painful debates in the past.
You don't put this in that category. All right.
No, really. I was prepared to be embarrassed, and I was prepared to Isn't that terrible?
I do want to let you know that I was reading one of the bloggers who said what he takeaway from the debate last night was that Culver sweats a lot. So I just want to let you know that was it. If nothing else, that means that he was excited and that people were noticing even the details, like he sweats a lot. So
okay.
It was an interesting debate, I'm sure.
Mary, thank you very much for calling.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. And we have just a minute or two left, but let's leave this conversation with your comments, Bruce and Arnie. Do debates matter? Can they matter? We have more debates coming up between Branstad and Culver. First to you, Bruce.
Yes, I don't think they don't exist in and of themselves, and they may not change and turn around an entire election, but they do give candidates opportunity to voice their messages to an attentive audience.
Okay, and 30 seconds for Arnie Arneson. What did you want to leave us with?
I think in a close race where people are undecided, the stature, the ability for someone to respond in a way that makes you feel like this is a person who can lead you. Governors matter. people don't know what, you know, senators do or members of Congress do in the House of Representatives, but they do know what a governor does. And I think probably the debate between gubernatorial candidates is the most important debate. The others, not so much, but this one, yes, especially when it's close and people are concerned about the future of their economy. So it's going to be, I think, even more exciting for the next two.
Okay, very good. New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson, thank you very much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And Bruce Nesmith, the Joan and Abbott Lipsky Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Coe College. Professor Nesmith, Bruce, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Ben.
And coming up on 12 minutes before the hour, this is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And now we want to pay tribute to legendary Iowa broadcaster Jack Shelley. He died in Ames last night at the age of 98. Jack Shelley was born in Boone in March of 1912, and he witnessed the beginning of broadcast journalism. He covered some of the biggest stories in history. In a moment, we'll be joined by Iowa Public Radio's Dean Borg to reminisce about the life and career of Jack Shelley. But first, we have this profile of Jack Shelley from Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson.
This is Jack Shelley on Guam. The wire recording you are about to hear was made at a beat.
10 years after starting his journalism career at the Clinton Herald, Jack Shelley was covering World War II for Des Moines radio station WHO.
It was the best view of a dive bombing I've had yet. You can plainly see the cluster of bombs released from the...
Having already chronicled the brutal conditions at the Battle of the Bulge, Shelley was in Guam when the atomic bombs fell on Japan and was one of the few reporters to interview the B-29 crewman.
The first man I talked to is the commander of the plane that dropped the first of the atomic bombs on Hiroshima, Japan. He is Colonel Paul W. Tippett, Jr. of Miami, Florida. But a few minutes after I met him, I discovered that he lived for a number of years in Des Moines. But immediately after the bomb was released and the explosion occurred, he said, the sight that greeted his eyes was hard to believe. After the bomb had exploded, and by the time we could turn around and get a look at it, the city was a mass of dust. We knew that we would encounter a very brilliant light, and all crew members had been issued a goggle similar to the type of a goggle that a welder wears.
Japan was defeated, and on September 2, 1945, the Boone, Iowa native was on the battleship Missouri for the surrender ceremony, and Shelley's radio account was broadcast to a national audience.
You see their leader, Foreign Minister Shigemitsu, has a right leg that's almost useless. Apparently, it's an artificial limb. He takes the steps very slowly, one foot at a time. The NIP delegation lines up alone in three rows, standing stiffly while the cameras grind and flash. He is certainly a fitting symbol of the beaten, crippled country he represents today.
After the war, Shelley returned home as WHO's news director, and in 1953 found himself on the receiving end of an atomic bomb during a test explosion in Nevada.
The men stand silently in the trenches, just the steel helmets showing above the parapets. These trenches are about 5 feet deep. They are lined with tar paper and with chicken wire. We have sandbags at the top.
8 minus 4 minutes.
It was one of Shelley's most suspenseful reports, and the retired Iowa State University professor had always said it was one of his favorites.
We've been told to kneel down and to stay down. The loudspeaker is giving us instruction. There goes the siren. To the right and the left of me, the troops are kneeling. Their heads are bent. I'm going to put my hand over this microphone when the moment comes of the blast. 3, 2, 1. There's the bright light with my eyes shut. I can see that tremendous light. The earth is shaking underneath me. Not too bad. There's the sound. There is the tremendous sound. This trench is being filled with dust. But I can see dimly the men to the right and the left from me. I can see them. Nobody seems to be in the least degree hurt.
Including Jack Shelley, who went on to teach many of the reporters who bring us the news today.
Iowa Public Radio's Rick Fredrickson with that remembrance in the life of the legendary Iowa newsman Jack Shelley, who died last night at the age of 98. Joining me now with some personal remembrances of Jack Shelley, a legendary Iowa newsman in his own right, a man who worked for many years covering the same Iowa news landscape as Jack Shelley, and a man who in 2008 won the Iowa Broadcast News Association's highest honor, the Jack Shelley Award, Iowa Public Radio's senior correspondent, Dean Borg. Thanks for joining us today, Gene.
Nice to be here, Ben. Nice to recall Jack Shelley.
And to celebrate his life, share with us your strongest personal recollection of Jack Shelley.
Well, it's two things. That distinctive voice, you'd never miss it. Jack Shelley's voice was very distinctive. And his ability to ad-lib. You heard it in what Rick Fredrickson just gave us here. But also, the earliest recollection I have of that distinctive voice was on my grandfather's farm. I'd often visit there in northern Iowa, and it was during the World War II era. My uncle, my grandfather's son, was in the Pacific Theater, and at that time, you know, you didn't have any contact like we do today with email and things like that. Letters took maybe weeks and months to get there because they were censored, first of all, and then so the 12:30 newscast from WHO was the contact. There they would read the casualty reports, and often Jack Shelley, if he wasn't doing the newscast or was reporting from the theater, he would have mentions of people's names that he had seen, Iowans he had seen, and that was the contact.
So people were listening on the farm around Iowa for the name of their sons at battle.
Everything came to a stop during the noon hour, during the war, and on that farm at least, and I think many others, and in by the radio, battery-powered radio.
Now, he called himself a Joe Blow reporter. I don't know if anybody would pick that as their own title. What did he mean by that?
Well, he meant that even though you've heard him covering some momentous things in history, he'd like to go to briefings with the military people. And after the officer finished briefing the troops, Jack would say, "Any Iowans here?" And maybe there would be two or three. Sometimes, I suppose, maybe none. But he would then write down those names, and in a report he would mention, "I saw Eric in last name, or John so-and-so," you get the point, from Hampton, Iowa, Mason City, Iowa, Dubuque. And that was that family's contact, that their boy was still alive.
Mm. Now, well, this is also a time when print is really the dominant form of news, and broadcast, if we can imagine it, is in its infancy. And Jack Shelley represents a print journalist more than a broadcast journalist. At least his roots are there.
He was trained in print journalism at the University of Missouri. He went to work, first of all, out of college at the Clinton Herald, and from there to WHO, took over as news director at WHO from H.R. Gross, another name in Iowa politics, in 1940.
Now, after the war, Jack Shelley returned from covering World War II, and journalism is changing at this time, the shift from the dominance of radio news to television news. How did he fit into that?
Jack had to adapt again, and for print to radio, now to television, I don't think Jack ever really felt comfortable in front of the camera. He was most often most comfortable where he could ad-lib and let his personality shine through in radio.
Now, we have a little bit of audio from Jack later in his life reading some tidbits of news. We want to hear a few seconds of this, but tell us what this is.
Well, you know, you've heard the hard news, as we would say it. He also, because of his love of Iowa and the countryside, native of Boone, he would read the newspapers, weekly newspapers from across Iowa, glean tidbits from there, and had a 5-minute weekly report called the Hometown News, and that's what you're going to hear.
Okay, let's listen to a little bit of Jack Shelley, Hometown News.
Just time to close with this one about the father who was reminded of the legislature every time he looked at his two teenage daughters, and he told them, "You ought to run for the legislature. You're terrific at introducing new bills into my house." Jack Shelley says, "See you next weekend."
What a fitting ending for this tribute to the wonderful life of a legendary Iowa newsman, Jack Shelley. Dean Borg, thank you for those remembrances. It's a pleasure. I can see you beaming across the table from me, being able to talk about this man.
Thank you.
Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio's senior correspondent. And we want to take you out with a little bit of period music from Jack Shelley's early days. This will ring a bell with many of you out there as well. The Exchange is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of The Exchange available at iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.